about to do it like this, about to do it like this, y'all.
One, two, three.
When I sit back and imagine life without you, I can't fathom how I ever thought I'd make it on my own. And there's at least a million reasons I'm still standing here believing you're my comfort, you're my healing. This I know.
Yes, I know.
You can't see the wind, but it moves the leaves from the bottom to the top of the tallest trees. You are everything that I'll ever need, and they can't take that from me. And I've been sort of sad this week because it's Labor Day weekend. And this is the video from 2015, which was the final Faith Quest 2 years ago. And it really did capture some of the craziness and weirdness. I reposted a video this week that was just several hundred teenagers crammed into the dining hall at Camp Yamhill. Because we had to do a quick head count, it was the best way to see if anybody got hurt when the tree fell down across the stage. We'd all been down there at the stage. Jason Hill had a lineup of nearly a dozen people leading worship. We finished that session, sent kids to bed, and a tree cracked, crashed, and fell across the stage. It brought down the canopy over, and so we're going, we don't know if anybody got crunched under there or not. Took out all the lights that Roy was in charge of. So we got all the kids together in the auditorium and we had to count heads. And in the midst of all that, worship broke out and we're kind of going, well, actually we counted whole bodies. We were hoping not to find any just heads. Thanks for clarifying that, Phoebe. Faith Quest was a grand celebration. Jacob is the man he is today because of Faith Quest. And it's done. But it was a glorious finale. It was loud and boisterous and crazy. And some grand finales are just that. They're grand. That's a person you know. There are moments when the celebration is big, and oh, and by the way, Faith Quest was where Roy Kunkel met Patty Jacobs. And because of Jesus, they fell in love. But it happened at Faith Quest. And Malcolm and Suzanne. Oh, and almost my friend Doug met Jesus that day. We had our first big crisis. Of all the bad ideas that we did at Faith Quest, some things that really should have had injuries and broken bones, nothing bad happened until the final moment. And Doug, who's been bringing high school kids to Faith Quest for years, bothers to have a heart attack. And so he gets life flighted out. We're kind of going, bye, buddy. Crazy things have happened. Some finales aren't grand and glorious and include helicopters. Some finales are like my mom's. My mom passed away last February. And she's been having low blood pressure issues for years. And so when she sort of collapsed at the retirement home, they took her to the hospital, and my sisters and my wife, they were all at a Burkett Women's Retreat, but Mom didn't want to go that year, so they were all out of town, and Ramona Burkett Woods was home, but she collapsed. They took her to the hospital. Me and Greg went to check on her. The two brothers are there checking on Mom, and they're running all kinds of tests, and so we'd been there several hours and talking and joking and having a good time with Mom, but finally it's several hours past lunch, and we Woods boys don't miss a lot of lunches, all right? So he said, "Ever gonna go grab a bite to eat? Be back in 20 minutes." So we go grab a taco and we come back. And the nurse meets us because Mom's not in the room. They said, "Your mom had a heart attack." We were only gone 20 minutes. She said, "Oh, no, not just now. Early in the day or maybe last night." What? And so they were running extensive tests. And over the course of the next 12 hours, we watched Ramona Jane Burkett Woods and her finale. Greg and Kevin sang together, sang hymns with Mom and over Mom. The best moment, Mom got in a delightful dig. One of Greg's sons comes in, and I don't know why Ethan was one of my mom's favorites when she had my children to choose from, but my nephew was one of Mom's favorites, and he comes in and he automatically starts crying, and Mom hugs him, and she says, she whispers in her ear, "I'm not dead yet." And we sang, and pretty soon all the sisters came in from out of town, and we surrounded her bed and we sang. And grandchildren that normally aren't in town were there, and in-laws, and the room was crowded, and we sang. And there just came a moment when we realized we're not singing to her anymore. Some finales are grand and glorious and boisterous, and some are gentle and quiet. But no matter how things end, it's really important that people like us are paying attention to the gravity and the weight of the moment. Around the room, I want you to make sure that you have one of these pieces of paper, and we're not going to jot down a lot of stuff, but I need for you to take this and jot down a few things. And here you go, Phoebe. And then keep it for the next several weeks. Because the last book in the Old Testament, the book of Malachi, is one of those grand finales. It's not one of those that ends with a big bang and a flourish and fireworks. It's one of those quiet, subtle things that it's really important that you read between the lines, that you're searching for meaning, that you're trying to grasp what just happened. What did we just hear? What did we just experience? The big deal here is this. God is speaking through a prophet, like he'd been doing for hundreds of years previously, but when he spoke to Malachi, and when Malachi spoke the words, Jehovah God was done talking for 400 years. This concludes the Old Testament in every way. God, who's been speaking through men and women up until this point regularly and clearly defining what his desire for his people, for the Hebrew people, is, we get to this moment. And in just a few short chapters, Malachi says, the quiet, simple, profound words. And we got to pay attention. It's only going to take you 15 minutes to read it. Over the next 4 weeks, as we look at four chapters, I want you to not read a chapter a week. I want you to read through it several times. Because there's going to be things that you're going to read on the third time through that you're kind of going, I didn't catch that. Or, oh, I'm seeing some things that I didn't catch before. There are real life answers that are going on to real life questions. There's some things that have to do with real life that I want first to pay attention to. Look at this next slide. Would you just read through this list with me out loud? Priority, generosity, contentment, relationship, integrity, growth, and selflessness. Say it again. Read it with a little bit of, ask for a little bit of discernment to see if you can kind of figure out, okay, these are big deals. Here we go. Priority, generosity, contentment, relationship, integrity, growth, and selflessness. These really are life answers. These are foundational principles that I think, if you pay attention, if you sort of get an idea of big picture, you can come up with, oh, that is balance, because we really were made for relationship. Oh, that is important, because living with integrity and honesty makes me a better man and more capable, and thinking about what's most important, priority, and thinking about, these are big deals. It's pretty balanced. It's pretty complete. If you are working to grow in all of those areas, especially in the area of growth, I don't know. If you are growing in those seven areas, you're going to be a healthier person. You're going to be more balanced. It really is sort of a complete picture of healthy humanity. These principles are universal. Whether you believe in Jesus or not, this is good thinking. Let me give you some background. Malachi. His name literally means my messenger. So this prophet of God, who is going to be a messenger for God, he grows up with his mama and his daddy telling him, you're a messenger from God. You got something you're going to be saying. It's interesting about this character. That's all we know. Isaiah the prophet, we know his dad's name. We know where he came from. We know what his family background is. Same thing with prophets and priests. We know we've got some history. Malachi, we got no other markers. We just have this messenger. Some theologians think, I don't think he was a guy. I think this is a message from God. I think it's a person, but I don't have anything to base that on necessarily. Historically, let me tell you what's going on. He's speaking these words about 1,000 years after Abraham. Let me give you a bit of a timeline. So this is just a sketch. This is a partial history. But way back in the year 597, God has been warning the Jewish people for a long time, if you don't turn around, if you don't follow me, it's not good for your future. As a matter of fact, you might remember that the Jewish nation comes from Jacob, and the Arab nation comes from Esau. Those two brothers had a parting of the ways. God finally said to the nations that came from Esau, you're not seeking me. I've given you all the chances I can. you're not in pursuit of relationship with me. And so he lets him go. And in the meantime, he's begging the Jewish nation, guys, pay attention. But finally, he says, okay, let me tell you what's going to happen. And through the prophets, he starts saying, turn or the nation will be gone. Now, these people were saying, but God's going to protect the temple. And God even stepped back away from the city of Jerusalem where the temple is at. And these guys that were sort of pridefully saying, he would never let this happen, it really did happen. And so it happened beginning in 597. The nation of Babylon, which is the powerhouse at the time, they come in, they conquer Israel, and they say, and we're going to take the important people, the influential people, and we're going to take them away. Several other deportations happened. They had this clever way of conquering a nation. They would take you out of your home, march you hundreds of miles away, and settle you in a place where you didn't know the language, where you didn't have control anymore. Everything about your life, daily experience, reminded you, we're under somebody else's control. They would move some stranger into your house, been in your house for generations. Not anymore. You've got no control. And so the first deportation happens in 597. In 548, that's the time when finally God says, all right, you people have been dragged out of your homes for several, in several waves. Now I'm gonna offer you some trust, and I'm going to send you back home. And led by the prophet of Ezra, you need to read the book of Ezra, and that'll provide you a little bit of understanding. Ezra takes some people back to Jerusalem and begins rebuilding the city. And it's a historic moment, because finally God is relenting on this harsh, difficult, burdensome discipline that he's put on them. The reigning nation was Babylon, but in the midst of the next several years, the conquering nation of Babylon gets conquered. So not only are the Hebrew people oppressed by the Babylonians, but now the Persians under King Artaxerxes have stepped in, and they'll say, we'll take the keys and we're in charge now. And they're oppressive in some new and some exciting ways. In 516, now the temple is being worked on, the city's being rebuilt, and in 561, it's finished. And the Hebrew people are kind of going, okay, this is really good. We've got some control here. It would be interesting for you to read Ezra, but also the book of Nehemiah and the book of Haggai and Zechariah. Those four books, they're all starting to tell different facets of the same story. In the year 444, it's 14 years later, and Artaxerxes, he's the Persian king, he's the one that says, you know, maybe it's time to do something different. One of the things that these conquering people would do also is to bring in the young, influential people and put them to work, not just in nice jobs, but put them to work in their court. And so the book of Daniel is one of those stories where this young Jewish guy and his friend Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they're brought into this new system and they're given new names. But the way they control the people is by changing these young leaders to think like the new regime. And so the right-hand man to King Artaxerxes is actually a Jewish guy named Nehemiah. He's the cupbearer. He's the one that tastes the wine to make sure nobody's trying to poison the king. That's a guy you gotta trust. Nehemiah finds out from his Jewish people that live in Jerusalem that while the temple's being built, there's no protection. The walls of the city are totally untouched, and it's been years, 14 years since Ezra, and nothing's being done, and he's just blown away by this. And finally, he holds himself together, but one day the king says, dude, what is your problem? You look so sad. And he did one of those, oh, I'm fine. No, 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 you're not fine. What's going on? And he takes a breath and he says, my city is in ruins. I mean, it's been rebuilt, but the walls are undone. And so the Persian king says, we've got to do something about that. And he finances Nehemiah's trip back, complete with money, complete with free passage between here and there, and a group of people. And Nehemiah goes in, and now he's the governor of the city, and he puts people to work. There's all kinds of people that you need to read the book of Nehemiah. Not only does he put things aright in the city as far as the protection goes, but he knows that the protection of the heart comes through being obedient. And so he says, guys, we haven't been practicing the various festivals and celebrations that God has told us. And this is part of our heritage. We've got to celebrate the Sabbath. Stop working. On the Sabbath day, stop. Guys, we're supposed to make sure our bloodlines are clean. Stop marrying people that aren't of the Jewish faith. And so he really strongly straightens things out. And there's lots of trial and lots of trauma. But it works. And in 435... and so he gets things set up, he goes home, and in 433, Nehemiah comes back to check on things. And this is the golden moment when Malachi says his words. Malachi begins to write, and somewhere during that time, when Nehemiah comes back and he's going, what? You're still marrying the pagans? People, what? You're still not obeying Sabbath laws? What about the Passover? What about what? And so it's in that context that Malachi speaks, that the messenger of God stands up and speaks some hard words, some harsh words. Israel has a heart condition. Israel's going through some things, and it's sort of important to not just beat them up, but sort of get into their heads and their hearts and realize they used to find some value and some self-worth in the fact that they were God's people. And now they didn't feel God's presence at all. They used to have a home, and now they were homeless. They used to be at least a little bit of somebody in Babylon, but now Babylon was old news. They were cast aside. They were invisible. They were a blip. They were a speck of dust. They were just nobodies. They'd heard words of hope from Haggai and from Zechariah. And so they sort of waited for this glorious future that Zechariah and Malachi promised. And they waited and they waited, and nothing happened. And so they were doing the right things. They were going through the motions. They were making the sacrifices to God. They were saying all the right words, but their hearts and their microphones were not involved. They were going through the motions, but there was no passion. It was dull. It was obligatory. And so the questions start. In the next 4 weeks, we're going to look at seven questions. We're going to deal with the first question tonight, and the next 3 weeks after this, we'll do two questions each night. There's actually more questions. You can figure out which ones got left out and why I left those out. But you can hear the hurt in their hearts with the first question in chapter 1, verse 2. When they ask, how have you loved us? They've been waiting for this glorious re-beginning. They thought something more remarkable was going to happen. But now they're looking at God and they're going, how have you loved us? Malachi calls them to change their lives, but they're shrugging their shoulders and they're going, I can't tell when you're there. I don't know. That's where they're at. There's this malaise. There's this empty-hearted experience. There's a lot of sighing going on. That's their condition. But let's consider God's condition. He begins by saying, this is the message that the Lord gave to Israel through the prophet Malachi. He says, I've always loved you. I've always loved you, says the Lord. As you read through Malachi, I want you to listen to God's tone, because here's what I think you're going to catch. He's sad. He's a broken-hearted lover that starts out the conversation by saying, you know how much I love you. He whispers, I've always cared for you. But he's worn down and he's weary. There's an interesting contrast. The beginning of the Old Testament and the end of the Old Testament sound and feel really different. It starts off with, this is the first few moments after God's created everything. So, God created human beings in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. Then God blessed them and said, be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and govern it. And then God looked over everything he made and he saw that it was very good. Genesis is filled with hope as this story is getting started. It's bright. He's going through day one, good. Day two, good. Day three, good. Day four, good. Day five. He gets to day six and he makes man in his own image and he says, very good. And then he institutes the Sabbath. And God, who needs no rest, does it just for us. And he says, and now I'm just going to sit back and enjoy all the work that I've done so far. That's how it starts out. What a contrast to Malachi. Chapter 4. This is how the Old Testament winds up. Beginning at verse 2. But if you fear my name, the Son of Righteousness will rise with healing in his wings, and you'll go free and you'll leap with joy like calves led out to pasture. On the day when I act, you'll tread upon the wicked as if they were dust under your feet, says the Lord of the heaven's armies. Remember to obey the law of Moses, my servant, all the decrees and the regulations that I gave him on Mount Sinai for all of Israel. Look, I'm sending you the prophet Elijah before the great and dreadful day that the Lord arrives. He will be preaching and will turn the hearts of fathers to their children and the hearts of children to their fathers. Otherwise, I will come and strike this land with a curse. And so even though he's been brutalized for century after century by this lover that keeps prostituting herself out over and over and over again, people that will go through the rituals and do the right things and say the right things but feel nothing, he's finally married to this gal and he says, there's still hope. The sun's going to rise and there'll be healing in his wings. I'm going to send a prophet just like Elijah who's going to turn your hearts back. But he sounds final. And he sounds tired. And he sounds done. You're going to come across that verse that says God hates divorce. Some of you that are divorced, sorry. Doesn't mean he hates you. But you know why God hates divorce? Because he's a divorcee. Because he knows how hard it is to get to a place where you're going, this isn't a marriage anymore. I don't know what you call this, but this isn't marriage. This is God's punctuation. This is how the sentence concludes. These are his final words. So, question number one, I want you to jot this down. Question number one is, how have you loved us? As far as those life principles, this is the one that's about relationship. And the people aren't being snotty or ugly. It's just that Malachi is posing a question that really is in the hearts of his people. God is posing a question that really is in the heart of his people. That's what God was doing then. And that's what God is doing now. And the reason why I want for us to wrestle with this is pretty simple. We've got to pay attention and make application. We've got to listen to their questions because their questions are universal. And all of us go through a time when we feel separated from God, when we don't feel, when we don't hear, when we don't know. And when he says, I've always loved you, we're the ones that are shrugging our shoulders and saying, how? How have you loved us? Why didn't you rescue me? Why aren't you taking care of this? Where are you? The question isn't, do you struggle to follow him? The question is, what do you do when you do struggle to follow him? Because we do. So with each of these profound questions over the next 4 weeks, we're going to go through this same process every single time. The question is, when they ask, how do you love us? The message there, the underlying words is, we can't see you. Jot that down. We can't see you. We're trying to follow you. We're trying to hear your voice, but we don't know. The real problem is lost relationship. Or maybe the problem is a sense of blindness. That is, we want to be attentive to his leadership. We want the right things, but we just no longer can feel him, no longer aware. And each week, that last slot is going to be sort of hard because those are about them. But this response is about me. And you can jot down anything there you want. Maybe it's how will I respond to him? Or what does responsiveness look like in my world, in my life? Maybe it needs to be introspective questions like, when was the last time that I felt like I was following with passion and could hear his voice? And what's changed? And how am I different? Let me wrap it up by saying, how do we question God's loving relationship? In my heart, I ask that question, you know, why? Why are you not nearby, God? Why am I not feeling this? But sometimes I need to ask myself, how did I get here? let me toss out a few things. Maybe it's this reality that pain and suffering cloud my understanding of Him. And so I go through hard times, and all of a sudden I'm going, well, I don't know what God's presence feels like anymore. I can give you a personal example. When Jesus said, whatever you ask in my name believing, I will do it. When my son was sick with cancer, I prayed that prayer with faith. And my son died. And Brenda and Kevin and Jessica and Ryan and Ryan's family and Jennifer and Tara, we were stuck going, okay, that verse doesn't mean that. What does it mean? And all of a sudden, we're having to redefine what it means to know Him, to understand Him. Pain and suffering clouds our understanding. Sometimes we aren't sensitive to God's love as He displays it, as He makes it evident. In chapter 1, verses 2 and 3, I've always loved you, says the Lord, but you retort, really? How have you loved us? Sometimes my definition of what true love should look like between human and divinity is not what He's offering to me. Sometimes I'm just not sensitive. I want Him to use my definition instead of doing what is best for me. Sometimes we're just forgetful or ungrateful. Chapter 1, verse 6 says, a son honors his father, and a servant respects his master. If I'm your father and if I'm your master, where's the honor that I deserve, the honor that I respect? And finally, we reject a father's right to discipline us. Hebrews 12 talks about a good father disciplines his kids. You and I both know of children that were raised in homes without discipline. And that's not loving parenting. A good parent is one that helps a child to define what good behavior and bad behavior is. First, a parent draws lines for their kids and says, if you cross this line, the discipline's going to be real. And it's not because they don't love, it's because they love. So, where do you see God moving, and how do you respond? We couldn't have Baptism Sunday last week because we were at Donna Teresa's house, and there was no place to set up a baptistry except for their bedroom. Okay, next time. But the baptistry is set up in the courtyard. And maybe it starts now. Hey, Roy, would you go get all the children and bring them in while I wrap this up? Don't go away. This sense of paying attention to God's nudges and God's calling is real and tangible and hard. And in the next several weeks, we're going to have some tough questions. I need to say, too, I hope you're not expecting some tidy answers from me, because this is a series that I put off for a long time because I'm spending a lot of time shrugging my shoulders because I'm going, I don't know. I don't know what this means. But I'd rather be a spiritual leader in your life and in your world that is willing to say, I don't get this, than to offer you platitudes that just make you feel more empty and more alone and more isolated from Him or from one another. Ask yourself questions like, okay, what does this look like? What does this feel like? Do I have seeds of bitterness? Are there things that I'm holding against God? Are there ways that I can be more genuine and more sincere about God's movement and God's presence? Ask yourself some tough questions. Look at things like gratitude. Are there ways that you're looking to express your thankfulness to Him, and what does that look like, and how does that feel? Ask yourself the why questions. Here's this reality. Before I even spoke a word, He cared for me. Before I did anything, said anything, before I had anything to forgive, before any of those seeds of ingratitude had blossomed into something big, and before I did it, He had already fallen in love with me. As a matter of fact, we sing a song where we talk about Him singing a song over us. Oh, it's huge for me to think in terms of, oh wait, He made the first move. Before I drew my first breath, He was already breathing life into me. He was the one that was taking the action. That crazy, illogical, senseless, reckless, divine love that He pours into us is startling. It's impossible. It's nothing I can earn. It's nothing that I deserve. But He continues to give Himself to us. In Genesis, keep going. In Genesis 3, man has fallen, and sin has entered the world. We all kind of stand there beside Adam and Eve, going, we're in the club. We get it right now. Like them, we listen to the serpent, and like them, God steps back into the garden. And I like it that it says, He was walking in the cool of the evening, and in the stillness of the night, God asks a question that He already knows the answer to. He says to the only two people on the planet, where are you? But He knows the answer. The question really wasn't for them. It wasn't a location question. It was a location question. We're sort of hiding over here because we're naked. And He asks another question. Who told you were naked? The only hope that we have is in Jesus. And that baptistry is set up because that sun that Malachi mentions that's going to rise with healing in His wings, that sun, S-U-N, is the sun, S-O-N. And the Son of God came here to give us some relief because sin entered the world, and we, like those two, have to go, we're over here. And the only hope we have is through the Son. If you need to be baptized, and tonight's a good night for it, we would love to surround that place for you and with you. We're going to sing that song. Listen carefully to the words. Pick out one lyric that hits you deep. And if you need to be baptized, come talk to me. We're going to pray together. And when the song's over, we'll head out as a family so that you can make that choice and that decision. God, take this moment and allow us to hear Your voice as we express our love to You. Stand. Sing this.
For I I took a breath, you breathe your life in me. You've been so, so kind to me. Oh, the overwhelming, never-ending, reckless love of God. Oh, it chases me down, fights till I'm found, leaves the 99. I could earn it, I don't deserve it, still you give yourself away. Oh, the overwhelming, never-ending, reckless love of God. Fought for me. You have been so, so good to me. When I felt no worth, you paid it all for me. You have been so, so kind to me.
No shadow, no shadow.